Hello and welcome to this episode of the Jam Bass Podcast, which is part of the Osiris Podcast Network. I'm Andy Kahn, and co-hosting with me today is Scott Bernstein. Hey, Scotty B.
What's up, AK?
Not much, man. We'll get the show started here in a moment, but first, let me tell you about our sponsor, CBD Vermont. CBD Vermont partners with organic farms in Vermont to produce organically grown hemp used in full-spectrum extracts that are available for sale at cbdvermont.com. Use the code JAMBASE. That's J-A-M-B-A-S-E at checkout to get 15% off all of their products. CBD Vermont guarantees their farms a price per plant and provides cultivation support throughout the growing season. There are a lot of CBD products out there, so how do you know what you're getting? Well, CBD Vermont tests all of its extracts to ensure you're getting the right amount of CBD and other cannabinoids and no unwanted toxins. Plus, each batch is traced to the Vermont farm where it was grown and the hemp cultivar that it was extracted from. They've recently launched an online store where you can buy Vermont-made CBD products, including oils, capsules, edibles, and topicals that have been fully vetted by the staff at CBD Vermont. I've mentioned before that I've been a proponent of the value of CBD for many years. Finding a source for CBD that I can trust hasn't been easy. But with CBD Vermont, I know that I'm getting high-quality products I can consistently rely on. CBD Vermont's variety of products are reliable, affordable, and effective. Go to cbdvermont.com and use the code JAMBASE, J-A-M-B-A-S-E, at checkout to get 15% off. All right, let's get to it, Scotty B. What do we have planned for this episode?
First up will be the rundown, where AK will recap his experience attending High Sierra Music Festival for the first time. After that, we'll hear my all-access interview with producer Jamie Schutz and audio supervisor Steve Nelson from the Trey Anastasio documentary film Between Me and My Mind. We'll hear my chat shortly, but for now, let's get into the rundown. As mentioned, Andy attended last weekend's High Sierra Music Festival, which was his first High Sierra Music experience. So, what did you think, AK?
Well, let me just tell you, first of all, I was instantly impressed by the beautiful settings. Plumas County Fairgrounds is in Quincy, California, and it is just majestic to the nth degree. It is beautiful everywhere you look, mountains and the Feather River. It was very impressive. And all that leads to quite an intimate vibe, I thought. It's a really special event. You can tell that over 29 years now, they've really honed what they're doing there, and there's a specific sort of vibe that they're really trying to create. And a lot of that comes from the traditions that you see each year. Granted, this was my first time there, but as a first timer, it seemed pretty apparent that there's just a lot of traditional things, be it campsites or impromptu shows or the play shops and whatnot. All those things that happen just seem to have a really strong sense of tradition. And you get a really strong sense that a lot of the people that are there have been coming year in and year out. Lucked out with weather this year, I'm told. Again, it's my first time, but it was and it was hot, but it wasn't nearly as hot as what I've been told it can get to. So I hear we lucked out quite a bit with. And I also want to give a shout out to the High Sierra Music Festival organizers. I really thought the programming was nice this year. I thought there was I've been to a lot of music festivals, and I thought the flow of music, both from start to finish each day and then from day to day throughout the festival, just had a really nice feel to it and really seemed like it was well thought out, and you got a chance to check out a wide variety of music.
Very cool. Well, talking about music, can you give me some of your musical highlights? Like, what were some of the memorable sets that you caught?
Man, I got to go straight to Saturday afternoon. I saw the Del and Dog set. So that's Del McCurry and David Grisman, two icons of bluegrass. And they just delivered not just the most memorable sets at High Sierra this weekend, but one of the more memorable sets of music I think I'll ever see in my life. The two are just incredible presence on stage. I could tell that they weren't working off a set list. They were coming up with tunes on the spot. And most of the time when they did so, then it came with a little history background that either mentioned Earl Scruggs or Bill Monroe or both. And I think one of the most powerful moments of the entire weekend came when they covered Man of Constant Sorrow. And afterwards, David Grisman stepped up to the microphone and said emphatically, "That's for Jeff Austin." And I get goosebumps every time I tell this story. I'm getting it again, right? Getting them again right now. It chokes me up a little bit. The crowd response was at least 2 minutes of just roaring, emphatic cheers. It was literally just one of the most special moments I've had at a concert. It was one of the most special moments of the weekend. And the weekend started out with the Rainbow Girls and Mapache both kicking things off at the Meadow stage. And they were both beautiful, nice, kind of easy sets to get started with. Mandolin Orange over on the grandstand stage that day on Thursday was similar, had a really cool vibe, kind of fit well with the afternoon as the sun was setting. The sun set. Kept setting on Carl Denson's Tiny Universe. I was stoked to get to see them do their Eat a Bunch of Peaches set, which is their tribute to the Allman Brothers Band. I ended up hearing a lot of Allman Brands Band all weekend long. Pigeons Playing Ping Pong were the de facto headliners that night. They weren't necessarily billed at the top of the poster, but they ended up being the last band to play on Thursday and proved that they can hold down that slot. You know, they've got practice from doing Dome Fest, and they showed that they know how to play that quote-unquote headlining slot. On Friday, we went over and caught Reed Genar and folks early in the afternoon. That was cool to see him interacting with Lebo on guitar and Scott Metzger on guitar. Love seeing those guys playing together. Jennifer Hartwick Band played a great set. I swung past the Chris Jacobs Play Shop where he was doing a tribute to Creedence Clearwater Revival. Dawes was a pretty impressive set. Those guys were really good musicians. They're a really tight band, and you could tell that they get out there and tour. The frontman Taylor Goldsmith took time to address the audience and say how thankful he was to be able to be asked back to play High Sierra again. And he seemed really genuine when he was mentioning that the band is very thankful for the ability to play live music for a living and that they don't take it for granted. One of the sort of unexpected highlights of the weekend, one of the bands I didn't know too much going about into, was Too Many Zoos. And that trio was just funky and energetic and lively, and they just brought relentless grooves that had the crowd just going wild to the point that they were climbing the trusses and security had to get involved. Another surprising set was the Stanton Moore and Skerrix Emerald Quintet, kind of a one-off thing that they had with Robert Walter on keys, Andy Hess on bass, and Metzger back on guitar. And man, our colleague Scotty Court said, you know, those guys need to tour, and she is right. That set was just, they sounded like a band that had been on tour. They were so tight. And I stuck around for a little bit of the late night set on Friday night. It was the Nth Powers tribute to Marvin Gaye that had Jennifer Hartswick and guitarist Nick Casarino just laying down some beautiful soul grooves. So back to Saturday, I saw that Dell and Dog set, and Grisman also sat in with the Del McCurry Band that followed right after that duo set. Caught J-Haw's Band again, was able to listen to Jim James as I walked around the fairgrounds and picked up some nourishment and some shade, much needed shade that day. It got a little hot on Saturday. Caught a little bit of Little Smokies. The band that I've seen the most going into the festival, Unfreeze McGee, I caught their headlining set and was quite impressed with how much improv they added to it. You don't always see that in festival sets. And they brought out Skerrick on saxophone for David Bowie's Let's Dance. Skerrick was everywhere all weekend, and it was fun to see him just... you'd be watching a band play, and then there's Skerrick going backstage, and then a minute later, he'd be up on stage.
Let's dance. to the songs that they're playing on the radio.
The late night set that night that I caught, well, I caught two of them actually. I caught the free ALO set, and that again was one of those, just reeked of tradition. It seemed like they were just like the High Sierra house band, and at one point they brought all the fans up on that were backstage up on stage, and a lot of them were like High Sierra staffers and stuff. And I'd also like to give a shout out to Maxwell Friedman. He is a 15-year-old keyboardist who was an artist at large this weekend. Saw him all over the place, sat in with ALO. Lebo said that he's known Maxwell since he was 3 years old. Maxwell is apparently from Bend, Oregon, and I was mesmerized by him this weekend. Every time he got up on stage, he just blew my mind. I mean, I can call him a kid. He's 15 years old, and the kid blew me away. He has serious, serious chops on the keys. I stuck around Saturday night for the late night set the New Master Sounds put on, and I think that band was made for those types of sets. They are the quintessential late night band. They brought Lamar Williams Jr. out at times to sing with them. Todd Stoops sat in on keys for a hot minute. It was a terrific, terrific set. Tried to get a little bit of sleep and then was up to in time on Sunday to see reggae legends and fellow UK band Steel Pulse. That was cool to get to see those guys for the first time. Another impressive set was the Sisters of the Strawberry Moon. We had Luther Dickinson on the podcast recently, and he discussed the project that he has going with Birds of Chicago and Sade Thomas. And once again, he had Graham Lesh sitting in with them. Graham played both guitar and bass with them. And man, they are just really impressive. Very emotional music at times. Not only just Luther's searing guitar work, but the vocalists that are involved in the project. Really cool original work. Caught Marcus King Band with Peter Levin on keys, and he fit that group like a glove. Caught a little bit of Talk. They're awesome. I love seeing those guys. They really bring it and know how to keep a festival audience going and dancing. The last set of the weekend that I caught was Green Sky Bluegrass on the main stage. They brought out photos that had been set up backstage as like a memorial tribute to Andy Gosling of Railroad Earth and Jeff Austin. And they had those actually sat up on the stage, and they played My Sisters and Brothers and dedicated it to those two guys. And it was just another touching moment of the weekend. Skerrick also sat in with Green Sky. Like I said, he was everywhere that weekend. The last thing I want to do is give a shout out to Bitchin' Kitchen, not only for the amazing food that they prepared each night, including one of my top three meals ever served on a paper plate, but for the impressive music that was hosted there all weekend. We saw Ron Artis, Marty O'Reilly, Mapache, Gene Navarro Jr., Chris Jacobs, Lebo, members of the California Honey Drops, Dave Watts of the Motet, John Craigie, and more. It seemed like there was music going nonstop from early afternoon until pretty late at night most of the time. And of course, there was also the set by the Jam Bass All-Stars, led by our own David Ottigman, featuring Natalie Cressman, Rob Marsher, Sean Leahy, Eric DiBardino, Scott Guberman, Jake Alexander, Marcus Schmidt, Connor Casey, Maggie Forte, and of course, Graham Ottigman. That was a lot of fun, you guys, and very, very well done. One of the things I heard all weekend that I mentioned before was how nice the weather was, given the mostly mild heat that we ended up having. But that wasn't quite what you experienced seeing Fish in Boston at Fenway, was it, Scotty?
Oh, man, I sure couldn't win. On Friday, it was 90 degrees and humid, and my seats were right in the sun. Thankfully, the sun dropped below the ballpark maybe midway through the first set, so that was okay. And then on Saturday, Boston got slammed with a thunderstorm that led to a two-hour delay. Thankfully, Fish decided to axe the set break and played 45 minutes later than they did the previous night. But, I mean, it was a real shit show in the corridors before the show. I lucked out in that my friends and I had a good perch for 2.5 hours from the time doors open at 5 o'clock. Actually, make that 3.5 hours until the concert started at 8:30. so I wound up, it wasn't so bad. Musically, I thought Phish played really well at Fenway in terms of the technical aspects and them being tight. When they jammed, most of the time they hit pay dirt. Sadly, there weren't that many jams, and honestly, those set lists just weren't up my alley at all. I was really hoping they'd do something special, especially on Saturday, considering all that fans went through, but it wasn't to be. I mean, when Thread is the biggest bust out of the run, you know you have problems with the set list. But, you know, I had a blast. It was really cool to see shows at Fenway. Thought the sound was great. I was concerned about the sound coming in. Had no problems on that end. Thought it was great. And, you know, as a Yankee fan, it's always nice to enjoy that venue without being a quote-unquote opponent. My highlights were the jams out of Mercury and Fuego, one of the better tubes played this era, and a run of What's the Use into Mexican Cousin into 2001 into Split Open and Melt. And the beauty of Phish is that even when you see below average shows, there's still plenty of highlights. And I guess that's one of the reasons I keep coming back.
Yeah, I'll be going back too this weekend to see the shows at Alpine, and I'm hoping that it's dry and not too hot. So that does it for the rundown. Now let's hear Scotty's interview with Jamie and Steve.
Welcome to an all-access segment of the Jam Bass Podcast, where we talk to music fans who turn their passion into jobs. I'm Scott Bernstein, and today I'm in Jam Bass's New York City headquarters with Jamie Schutz and Steve Nelson. Jamie and Steve each played a crucial role in the making of the Trey Anastasio documentary Between Me and My Mind. How's it going, Jamie?
Good, Scotty. Thank you for inviting us.
Well, glad to have you. How about you, Steve? How's everything?
Everything's great. Good to see you, Scott. It's been a while.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks for having us here today.
I'm glad to have you guys and really excited about the movie. I saw the premiere at the Beacon and loved it. Jamie, what role did you play in the making of the movie?
So I was a producer on the film.
And what are some of the roles that a producer, relating specifically to this project, what did that entail?
Yeah, well, specifically for this project, it was really coming up with the original idea and meeting with Trey and Patrick and pitching them on the film itself and then meeting with them and sort of putting it all together and working with Steve on the creative. I'm a Phish fan. Steve is not necessarily a Phish fan, so I had a lot of...
And when you say Steve, we're talking about the director of the
Cantor,
film, Steve Cantor, and Patrick is Patrick Jordan.
Yes, I'm sorry, Patrick Jordan. Exactly.
Phish and Trey's manager.
Exactly, exactly. And then really lining everything up from the crew to where we're shooting, when we're shooting, helping with financing, helping with the overall vision, obviously dealing with the Beacon and the premiere and distribution and a little bit of everything.
Terrific. Yeah. And how about you, Steve? Steve, what role did you play in Between Me and My Mind?
Okay, let me first just say Jamie's selling himself short a little bit.
Okay.
I don't think this film would have happened without Jamie. He did everything. He pulled all the strings behind the scene, right?
Thanks. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, listen, it's filmmaking is a team effort. But I've been a fan of Phish since 92, and this is something that... I've thought would be an incredible achievement to accomplish, and when a friend said, "Hey, if you could make a film on any band, who would it be?" I said, "Well, I've been a Phish fan for 25 years, so wouldn't that be cool?" He said, "Oh, I know the manager," so I got hooked up with Patrick, and then Patrick and I met and had a great meeting, and he said, "What are the next steps?" And I said, "Well, the next steps really are for you to bring your client in here to see if we all get along creatively." And so he brought Trey in, and this was November of 2016. And as many of you guys know, Trey had ideas, and they were bouncing off the walls, and we had a three-hour creative meeting. And then we're all excited, but still unsure whether Trey and Patrick would want to do this, because obviously they'd been pitched many, many times on on doing a film.
Right.
And they came back after that meeting and said, we're in. And I said, what? Okay, great. Now we got to make this sucker.
Right, because they haven't done anything like this in a long time, I think, since the last film. Since
Bittersweet Motel, which came out in 2000.
And right.
Wasn't exactly the most glorious portrayal of the fish scene. Not exactly something I was excited to show my parents.
Right, yeah. And so I think they stayed away from cameras for many, many years.
Sure.
Until Jamie came around and blessed us with this beautiful
project. You know, it's interesting. I mean, Trey said it actually at the Beacon. You know, look, I mean, Fish has been pitched 1,000 times on making a film. Both Trey and Patrick, Jordan and Corin, and Jason and everybody.
Fish's other managers.
Fish's other managers. And I think it just came down to persistence and timing, which is, you know, is a lot in life.
Sure.
And some good luck. And also, I think our pitch, I keep using the word pitch, it sounds so formal. It wasn't that formal, but our conversation was much more targeted on Trey's creative process. And as a fan, I have not seen that much behind the scenes of Trey's creative process. And I really wanted to sort of dive into that and figure out, like, what is this all about? Where does he come up with this stuff? And what motivates him? And how does he create a song? And how does he create an album? And who are the people that are important to him? And where is he in his life right now? And so I think, and Trey had said this at the Beacon premiere, that was really what got him interested about this, is just, you know, it's a inside look at a creative person.
Absolutely. As Trey said, we Fish has shown so many sides of themselves, but we've never seen that, the creation. And that seems to be what helped with the pitch. And Steve, how did you get involved?
Right. So I'm bringing it back to me. So I, the audio engineer on the shoot, on the project, basically, most of the time it was Jamie and I and a camera guy and Stephen Cantor and the three or four of us and Trey, the five of us. And I put microphones on Trey and the other people we were working with at the time, and I would record the audio. And I had a lot of different great experiences doing this.
You're a longtime Fish fan?
Oh, yes. I didn't mention that. Like Jamie.
The first time Steve touched Trey's chest, he said, I'm never going to wash his hand again.
I don't think that's true. I don't agree with that.
Just kidding.
Not me. No. But, yeah, maybe a little bit.
When did you first see the band?
My first show was July 31st, 1993, in Georgia, in Atlanta, the Masquerade, outdoors. Yeah. Wow, I was 15 years old.
Excellent.
It was definitely a life-changing event then, and I've been a fan ever since, for 20-something-odd years. And one day, I get a text message from Jamie, and he says, are you available? And, well, I actually have the text message here.
Okay.
I went back, and I found it, and it's great, if you don't mind.
No, by all means.
I'm going to read it to you.
Steve has his phone out, and he is gonna take us back, and you'll tell us when this took place.
Okay, here we go. This is April 4th, 2017. So this is gearing up to when they're gonna start shooting. From Jamie, what are you doing Monday? And I wrote, what you got? And he wrote, I have a shoot from 2 to 7 in Midtown. Wrote, I can't do it, I'm not available in the evening, thanks. He wrote, okay. 2 days later, April 6, 2017, I get a text from Jamie. Looks like it's going to be 2 to 6 on Monday, 9 to 4 on Tuesday, if that changes things. I wrote, could work. What is it? He wrote, I can't tell you, but you're going to want to do it. My response, and this is just out of the blue, is interview with Trey, Paige,
no
Mike,
way.
Fish.
Yeah. No way.
Mick, Keith, Paul, And then all of a sudden, I get a phone call from Jamie, and he tells me, we're going to be starting this project with Trey, and can you do it?
Yeah.
Count me in.
Yeah. That was actually the third day of filming. That was at Carol Music, right?
Right, yeah.
And we were filming. Trey had just written a couple of new songs and wanted to play them for James Casey and Jen Hartwick and Natalie Cressman. The horn section of Tab.
Right.
Yep. And they had never heard the songs before, and two of the three songs ended up becoming pretty big Phish songs. They were, they started as Trey songs. They became pretty big Phish songs. Everything's Right and Come Together.
Come Together, right? Yeah. I think that was it.
And we saw the genesis of that, which was, you know, Trey had done a demo on his iPhone, which he had worked on over the past weekend, and played it for them, and they just sat there listening, trying to hear their parts, and it came together.
Yeah, so he sent me the text, he called me, and the next day, I'm in Carol Music with Trey, teaching Jen and Natalie and Casey these new songs, a handful of new songs,
yeah.
A few of which was Everything's Right,
yep.
and Come Together. Is that the name of the song?
Rise/Come Together.
Yeah, Rise Up.
We weren't sure at the beginning.
I think
everybody was confused
because
at
the
first.
Beatles song, Trey would like to call it Come Together, but doesn't want to call it Come Together because of the Beatles song.
I think it's Rise Up?
So it's Rise/Come Together.
Oh, there we go.
It's the most ridiculous thing. So just call it Come Together. It's okay. It's allowed that there are two songs with the same title.
All looking for a little more love to shine a light that lifts us up. And when you hold me, heartbeat, I'm a part of you and you're a part of me. And we rise up and come together.
Right.
Is that the one that says in the sun's sun's coming up and the long night's over and the sun's coming up?
No, that is Everything.
that's everything's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
It's funny how you and I always mix those two up because we heard them at the same exact time in that session.
Yeah.
And I always mix those two up.
Yeah.
They're both
great. Trey's teaching them, you know, the harmonies and how it goes, and he's just playing it right there.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there. I've got microphones on Jen and James and Natalie and Trey.
Yeah.
And I put plant mics all around the room, and I didn't know what I was getting into.
Actually, I remember when he was teaching them Come Together, he's teaching them the chorus. They're listening. They're leaning forward in their chairs trying to hear their parts. And then he goes into the guitar solo, and there's like a, you know, 60 to 80 second guitar solo at that moment. And he stops all of a sudden. He's like, I could keep going on for days with this one. And he starts, you know, has that Trey laugh. But that was actually the third day of shooting. The first and second days of shooting were Northampton. That was in March of 17, and that was Trey's solo shows.
Okay.
That he had done. I think there were three shows. One was Northampton, and then there was
Portsmouth,
and then there was one more. I can't remember where it was. We just shot one of them. But.
Excellent.
Right, so I think at that point I wasn't on board. Maybe you guys were thinking we're going to test the waters, we're going to bring some cameras around Trey and see how it goes.
Yeah.
And then I guess, you know, a little further down the line, you called me.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Glad I did, pal.
It was me all the way out. It was a great experience. I mean, and so, like, you know, we saw the genesis of a few of those songs. And so now every time they play them,
you know,
it's a special place in my heart. You know? And if Jamie's around and I'm around Jamie, we look and we smile. It's great.
It's cool.
And how did Ghost of the Forest come into the equation?
Yeah, so when we met in November of 16, or I guess it was November of 16, we agreed that we wanted to focus on the creation of something. We weren't sure what that something was. And we had talked about a couple of different ideas. Trey was doing a symphony coming up, and that was something that was on the table. And then that sort of quickly got replaced with the idea of he's got these new songs that he is creating. And at the time, he wasn't sure whether those new songs were going to be part of an album, whether they were just going to be part of his repertoire. He really wasn't sure. In fact, there's a scene in the movie where he's sitting with Ben Collette, his audio coordinator, and he says, I don't know where these are going to go. And they eventually, of course, they became an album.
Sure. And what is your Steve, what's your background? When did you start getting into the audio game?
Right. So out of college, I moved to New York. Didn't have a job. Had a couple friends who went to film school at NYU.
Okay.
And they started getting me work, you know, doing production work around town. And as a production assistant, a utility, a grip. And then shortly thereafter, I saw what the audio guy was doing over there. I was like, hey, that's kind of interesting. And I started to stand next to the audio guy and asking him questions. This was back in 2002, I believe. Right. So it's been 16, 17 years. And yeah, I grabbed a mixer, recorder, bunch of wireless mics, booms, and started learning audio.
And what were some of the your favorite projects besides this that you've worked on over the years?
Well, I mean, obviously there's this one here, but I've worked on a couple with Jamie that have been real nice. You know, Jamie works in the documentary world. I worked on a project with them called Ballet Now, which you could see it on Hulu, I think.
Yep,
right?
Hulu. Yep.
Another one, What Will Become of Us, yeah. Right?
Just that's premiered a great that film. At Tribeca as well.
Okay. Uh-huh. So I've done a lot of different things from documentary films to sports to reality TV. I worked on the first five seasons of Project Runway, which was a great experience. Top Chef. So I've kind of been all over the map. Lately, I've been doing a lot of sports, which has been fun.
Excellent.
Keeps me out.
And as far as you, Jamie, how did you get into producing?
So I started my career in 95 here in New York, and I started working on commercials and music videos, and I eventually worked on a feature film. Happened to be Vin Diesel's very first film called Strays that he wrote and directed and starred in.
Okay.
That went to Sundance, and then from there I kept working on films. So I probably worked on about a dozen feature films, and then maybe, you know, 100 music videos and commercials, people with like Pink and Busta Rhymes and I don't know, Sheryl Crow and Whitney Houston. There were a bunch of people on there. And then in 99, I moved to Los Angeles and I got hooked up on the very first season of Survivor. And that was my first producing credit, actually. So I went to this crazy island in the middle of nowhere and shot this ridiculous show. And of course, it becomes this massive, amazing, you know, project.
Did you have any idea when you were there that this was something that was going to take on a life of its own and still be around 20 years later?
We knew we were doing something special at the time. We didn't exactly know how special, but we certainly knew that we were doing something really interesting and something that had never been done before. I mean, that format really was brand new. And it was a pretty magical experience. I mean, the first seasons of anything are pretty magical experiences because you're really figuring it out as you go along. Okay. There's no template for it. And Survivor was no different. I mean, we were figuring out every single part of the show as we were going along. But obviously, it was an incredible experience being a part of it.
Excellent. And then beyond that,
Yeah, so I worked on a couple of seasons of Survivor and then a show called Eco Challenge, which was the predecessor to Amazing Race. Both of those were Mark Burnett shows. And then worked with the late Mary Alice Bunim and John Murray, who started Real World and Road Rules, on a project for the old WB Network, which is now the CW. And then we made a movie together called The Real Cancun that we sold to New Line. And then from there, I was basically executive producing reality shows. And then in about 2010, I went over to Ogilvy Entertainment and I started working in branded entertainment. So I was basically traveling around the world making films for brands and TV shows for brands. And then in 2014, Stephen Cantor called me and said, hey, my partner's leaving Stick Figure. Do you want to come over and be my partner? And that was about 5 years ago. And it's been incredible since.
And some of the projects besides the Ballet Now, is that the
name? Yep, Ballet Now, yeah.
And Between Me and My Mind, what else has Stick Figure come out with since you've joined as the partner?
So 2016, actually right when we made right when we met Trey and Patrick, we were finishing up a film called Step that we brought to Sundance in January of 17, and we sold that to Fox Searchlight. That was an incredible project. We made a film called Dancer about Sergei Polunin, who's a very famous yet troubled ballet dancer from the Ukraine. And we made a film for ESPN's 30 for 30 series called Chasing Tyson. What Will Become of Us, the Frank Lowy film, and a couple of other projects here and there.
Terrific. Yeah. And you guys have both been longtime Fish fans. How long did the process from it was about March 2017 when you started?
Yeah, that's when we started shooting.
And when did you film until?
We wrapped officially we wrapped unofficially in the fall of 18.
Okay.
And then we would do a day here, a day there, just to pick up a couple of things that we felt were missing from the film.
Were you at Curveball?
I was not.
Okay. One of my questions when this project was announced was did the scene when the band was informed that Curveball was canceled get filmed? And you know, that would have been interesting. But we do see in the film some of the genesis of the Kasvot Vox Halloween set, and I thought it's so cool to see the band just vamping on the songs that they created. Steve, can you speak about the part of the process where you filmed the four guys together in Vermont?
And sure. Yeah. So, you know, we're making this film for a year and a half, 2 years. And I think we filmed a little bit at Madison Square Garden where we had the whole band, but we never really had the band, you know, in a private setting, you know, them just hanging out and being themselves. And so I think that was like one of the final filming days, was the final piece, you know, to, you know, make the whole project come together. And so I'm not sure if Jamie was there.
I wasn't there.
Okay.
No.
So it was Steven, myself.
I was there.
For when we filmed that, four of the band members.
Oh, no, I wasn't there for that one. No, I was there with Fishman a bunch, but not for that one.
Okay, Fishman was there for a couple of weeks, actually. with Fishman.
Fishman's very happy to hang out at the barn.
Yeah, for sure. So we, Stephen Cantor, myself, and
Johnny. Johnny St. Hours, our fantastic cinematographer.
Okay.
Yep. Johnny St. Hours, brilliant cinematographer. And he's got these fancy lenses that look so cool. And I know Trey likes them, too. Yeah. We went up to Vermont, and so from my understanding is, over the course of 3 or 4 days, they went into the barn, the four of them, and they recorded and wrote all this music. And when we arrived, they had kind of decided they were going to stay an extra day for us.
Okay.
I think that's kind of how it went down. So, because they were all there and we wanted to get this scene. So they stayed an extra day. And so when we rolled in, they, you know, the energy in the room was great. They were still working on a couple of the pieces. I remember Stray Dogs, you know, they were putting in some keyboards, and I walked into this and I'm like, wow, what's going on here?
Yeah.
This is great.
It's over there, it's over here, it's over there, it's over here, over there, over here, over there, over here, there, here, there, here, there, here, there, here, there, say it, dog.
And, you know, that was how I think the music part came together.
Right.
They did it in a very short, brief moment in history.
And did you know that what they were doing, that this was for Halloween at the time?
Okay. So, Jamie, there's a couple different stories out there about the origination of this. I think Jamie has one story about how this idea of, you know, we're going to go out there and we're going to be a different band and we're going to create this whole, you know, the internet and newspapers, and we're going to go out there and we're going to make a whole story about this band that exists, you know, from the 80s or 70s rock music, right? So Jamie might have a little bit of a story.
Yeah, it actually started, I think, a month prior to that or 2 months prior to that. I'm not exactly sure when. And you were there, I think, too. It was me, you, and Johnny, and Steve, and Trey. I don't know if Fishman was there. Maybe Fishman was. Was he there?
Yeah, Fishman was there.
And I can't remember whose idea it was, whether it was Trey's idea or Johnny's idea, or it was just a common, I think it was one of those things where, like, everybody sort of contributed to this idea of creating a fake band. and then Trey, of course, took it and ran with it. And I mean, it may have even been his idea. It probably was. I don't even remember. But I remember sitting there and we were all just sort of like laughing about how funny it would be if this fake band was created that inspired Fish all these years. And of course, it ends up being this incredible experience.
Quite a prank, I think.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely. A lot of people were sitting there trying to figure out what was going on.
So one of the major crux of the film is that we see the members of Fish learning Soul Planet in preparation for their New Year's show in 2017. How did the idea come together to capture that as part of the movie?
Well, we definitely wanted to create some sort of timeline. We weren't sure exactly how long the quote-unquote album was going to take that Trey was working on, if it was even an album, and it really had no ending. So we figured we needed to march towards something, and we knew, obviously, that every year they do this, you know, big gag, and so we just thought that that was a natural sort of timeline for us to... And we also knew that it was going to involve the other all the members of the band, so it just sort of became this, like, natural progression where Trey's doing one thing over here with this, you know, album, and then he's teaching the guys, you know, the New Year's song, and that gave us an opportunity also to go meet the guys one at a time.
Right. And Steve, your experience at MSG that night, what were you doing that night?
Well, you know, I've been to Madison Square Garden probably 50 of the 60 shows they've played, you know, as a fan, you know, out there in my seat. Well, this particular evening, I had an all-access pass, and, you know, we were there early. I believe we met up at Trey's earlier in the day. We hopped in the vehicle with him. We drove downtown. We drove into the garden with him. We followed. We tagged along with him all day, you know, and here I am, you know, backstage in Trey's dressing room, in the dining area, you know, on stage. I think there's a couple of photos of me on stage with the boom over Trey while he's working on, you know, warming up, but toying around with some of the new equipment that he had gotten.
Okay.
The new rig that, you know, we had filmed some of that. I don't think any of that made it into the film.
Also, we were there for sound check, and we were there for the David Gallo meeting and the rehearsal.
Right. Yep. So, yeah, there's a whole backstory to the whole thing. I mean, the first time I heard Trey explain New Year's, it was MoMA Dance.
Interesting. Yeah. So it did warp.
It was MoMA Dance. I mean, he was the sail, like everything. He was like, you know, like pulling the rope, and he was like explaining it to Steven, you know, on camera, and it was MoMA Dance, and it was gonna, you know,
blah, 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 still blah, in blah. That set, I believe.
Of course, because it was in the whole, you know, like out at sea sailing vibe. But the first time I heard it, it was MoMA Dance, and then maybe one or two, because, you know, here's what would happen. He would explain something to Steven 1 week, and then the next week I'd be there with Jamie, and he would explain it to Jamie some other way. And then he was with Jen. We were filming him with Jen, and he would explain it yet another way. So it's like these things are always evolving.
Yeah, you see? That's true.
And we see that as fans, but to really be there and experience that. And so eventually it was Soul Planet, you know? And a lot of work went into Soul Planet,
which we see in the movie. And it was pretty cool how we went to all the different band members' houses, and it was a really interesting experience.
Well, everyone's together on the Soul Planet. There's one beating hard on the Soul Planet. Dancing and breathing on the Soul Planet. There's no need to be running on the Soul Planet. Keep up rolling. Soul Planet. Spinning and turning on the Soul Planet. Screaming through space on the Soul Planet.
And there are a couple other things I wanted to touch on from the film. One scene that particularly struck me is Trey gets on a tour bus after, I believe it was probably the Tab shows in Oakland, and it is just, Trey looks like so weathered, and like he's put his whole heart and soul into this 4 hours worth of music, and it's just crazy to see what's left of Trey after giving himself to a concert. Who was on the bus with him for when that scene was filmed?
I was. Okay. It's still probably my favorite scene of the movie. And it actually, in the movie, we make it look like it came out of Oakland, but quite frankly, it actually came right after he performed at Kane's in Tulsa. And we're backstage behind the stage, and we see Trey take his final bow. And then he and Richard Glasgow, his tour manager, walk to the tour bus. And we have this single shot of us walking into the tour bus, and then eventually the tour bus leaves. And that is what happens after every show. Trey just gets on the bus, doesn't socialize, and leaves. And there's several reasons for that, but I wanted the audience to see the difference between the ecstasy of being on stage and the adulation that Trey receives to the loneliness and the quiet of being on tour by yourself, because quite frankly, that's what it is. And it seems very glamorous to be a rock star,
sure,
but it's also very lonely. And that is what Trey does every single day. He gets on the tour bus by himself and he's just off to the next city.
And how quickly did he go from sitting at that table pounding waters to picking up his guitar and going back in the back book and just playing guitar?
Within minutes. That's it's no accident that Trey is one of the best guitarists, you know, in the history of rock and roll. I mean, the guy always has a guitar in his hands.
Right.
And he falls asleep with it sometimes. It's incredible.
And one of the other main crux of the movie was Trey having conversations with important figures in his life, like with his family. Was there any guidance? I like that Trey served as the narrator, and it wasn't like somebody off camera asking questions, or at least it didn't appear that way. Was there any guidance given to Trey before those segments where he would talk to these important figures in his life?
Yeah.
Do you want to go?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think him and Steven Cantor, let's not forget about Steven, the director of the film. You know, him and Trey got very close, I think, over this, and they spoke a lot. I know Steven would tell me they would text or they would talk on the phone for hours. So I think Steven and Trey had a lot of conversation about family and how much that means in his life and how that affects everything that he does. And so I think that's something they spoke about. And so I think when we got to those places with mom and dad and daughters, you know, he was already ready to, you know, these are things, topics that he spoke about with Steven.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
So
there was a little bit. It wasn't just like off the cuff, this is what I'm going to do.
Well,
a lot of thought went into, a conversation went into, you know, what was going to be discussed around that time.
Sure.
And just to drill down into that a little bit further, I mean, we like to try to make films that are very character-driven, as opposed to, Scotty, what you were saying about having, you know, other narrators or other people's voices in there. We wanted this to be Trey's journey from beginning to end. And so what we said to Trey before we started rolling, and we didn't give him a lot of direction, but we basically said is, you know, ask questions. Ask questions of your dad and your daughters and your wife. Ask them, you know, were you a good father? Or we didn't even really give him specific questions to ask,
okay,
but we just said, you know, pretend that you are the audience wanting to know more about you, Trey. What questions would you ask your dad? You know, the film, the scene with Ernie, you know, was obviously like probably a 2-hour scene. You only see 6 minutes of it in the film, but I think it's one of the strongest scenes in the film.
Absolutely. It's incredible. And, Ernie, Trey's father, talks about Divided Sky and how that when Trey wrote that song, he had a new appreciation for what his son was capable of. And I'll never hear Divided Sky the same way again, just like you guys were talking about with The Rise Come Together and Everything's Right. So now Between Me and My Mind is coming to theaters on July 17th. Theaters all across North America. It's not only the US, it's also Canada.
Yep.
Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And after that, it appears that it's going to be at some venues across the country. I've seen they're starting to announce. And I think that's really cool because The Beacon was such a special experience, getting to take in the film with not just 80 people, but thousands of people. How was that night for you, Jamie?
Gosh. I mean, career highlight for sure. Anytime you make a film and you see it on the screen in front of an audience, it's just an exhilarating experience because you put so much hard work into it. But having 3,000 Phish fans who, you know, supported the film and loved the film, and having my friends and family there and having all the people that worked on the film there, it was just a dream come true. I mean, really, it's hard to even put into words the feeling. I felt like I was walking on clouds.
I'm sure. And how about you, Steve?
I mean, same thing, really.
Yeah.
You know, we put 2 years of our lives into this. And, you know, Jamie obviously did a lot more work than me. But just to, you know, I think when I'm watching the film, when I was watching the film, and I some of the moments, you know, it's like really special because like I was there, you know,
right.
Really personal. So it's really it was definitely a career highlight for me.
I want to just add, though, we've talked a lot about like you and me and Steve and Patrick and a little bit on Trey, but I just want to add that this film is so special because of one person specifically, and that's Trey Anastasio. I mean, he is one of the warmest, most gentle, most generous, most creative, most loving people you'll ever meet. And I feel so honored to have been working alongside him for the last 3 years on this project, because every single time I'm around him, it just rubs off. And it's no accident that Trey and Mike and Paige and John have built this incredible following, because they open their hearts and their minds to everybody and treat everybody like family. And that's what I think Phish fans are, and that's what Trey has cultivated. And you see that at a Phish show, but you also see that in Trey's living room. He's just a very genuine, amazing guy.
And for the three of us, having followed this band around for so long, it's so nice to see that this people that we're devoting all this time and attention and money towards are genuinely great people. And that's one of the things that I got from viewing the film. It was like a big hang with Trey, and he was everything that you just said. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the Jam Bass podcast.
Thanks, Scotty.
Thanks for all of your work, and I'm sure I will see you at plenty of shows in the future.
Looking forward to it.
For sure. Summer tour coming up.
Yep. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Scotty.
Thanks for checking out this episode of the Jam Bass Podcast. Jam Bass is the Osiris Podcast Network's media partner, and you can find and listen to all the podcasts in the Osiris Network by visiting jambass.com. We appreciate you listening to this podcast and for supporting Osiris. We always want to improve, and we want your input to be able to give you more podcasts and experiences that you love. So we're doing a listener survey. And if you complete the survey, you can enter to win an amazing limited edition original Osiris poster. We'll be selecting three winners at random. Go to surveymonkey.com/r/jambass to take the survey today. Thanks to this week's sponsor, CBD Vermont. Remember, go to cbdvermont.com and use the code JAMBASS at checkout to get 15% off. Many thanks also to Steve and Jamie for taking the time to chat with Scotty. Go see their Trey Anastasio documentary film Between Me and My Mind in select theaters nationwide on Wednesday, July 17th. Thanks as always to Telefunken for outfitting our microphones and to Jake Alexander for editing it all together. It was great seeing you last weekend, Jake. Thanks again to all of you out there for listening. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the Jam Bass Podcast. We'll be back soon. In the meantime, go see live music.